Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. After all the days associated with holiday shopping, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Cyber Monday, the nation's charitable causes finally got their moment on December 1st with a day dubbed Giving Tuesday. And on this fourth year since Giving Tuesday's inception, it seems to be doing pretty well, with dollar amounts reportedly almost triple from last year. That's in addition to overall U.S. charitable donations, which are seeing an impressive rise since the recession, according to the Giving USA Foundation. Still, from a donor's perspective, with all the appeals this time of year, it can be difficult to know where to put your dollars. Some experts will say, give locally. Others say, globally. Still others advise assessing it for yourself, using resources like Charity Navigator or GiveWell.org. But these guides also have their own philosophies, their own biases. So what's a donor to do? That's what we're talking about today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Whether you want some help figuring out how to give most effectively, or you've got your own strategies, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests for the hour. Amy Costello joins us from Texas. She's host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates philanthropy and nonprofits. You can find her at tinyspark.org. Amy's also a former Africa correspondent for the public radio program The World. And Amy Costello, great to have you. Thank you for being with us.
Wonderful to be here, Laura.
Also with us in studio, Mary Ellen Jackson, consultant and special projects contractor for the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, which provides programs and resources to support nonprofit organizations in the state. And Mary Ellen, welcome back. Good to see you.
Great to be here, Laura.
Well, big picture first, both of you, and Amy, I'll turn to you first. Statistics show that so far, 2015 has been maybe a record year for giving, surpassing giving in the pre-recession era. What are you seeing out there in terms of the big numbers?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have a hold of those specific numbers, but indeed, this does seem to be the time of year when people tend to give. I think many of us are feeling a little overwhelmed by all the problems we see out there, both in this country and around the world. And I think many of us are feeling that we need to do something. And so in some ways, because of the landscape out there, it doesn't surprise me to hear that giving is up, though, as far as I understand it, it tends to remain pretty steady year to year. We're not giving a lot more than we ever have. We tend to give about the same amount as we always have, although that changes a bit year to year.
What are you seeing in New Hampshire, Mary Ellen, in terms of the trends? You know, are we digging a little deeper these days or not?
Oh, I think we are. And I think the nonprofit community is also making strides in getting the word out and giving people a sense of how essential the services are. And you're seeing, you know, nationally, when you see Zuckerberg give $45 billion and you see the day of giving bring in $116 million, you realize people have a huge appetite and, well, actually a huge desire to take an action. The world is overwhelming right now.
Well, I want to pick up on that. And it's really interesting that you say that, Amy. Talk a little bit more, please, about that feeling that there are so many problems, that the world is overwhelming, that local needs are perhaps overwhelming. How does that affect giving? Because I'm wondering which way it goes. Maybe people feel so overwhelmed that they're immobilized, or maybe they feel overwhelmed and they, you know, just try to do whatever they can. So what are your thoughts there, Amy?
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I know for myself, I often feel overwhelmed and then therefore paralyzed about, you know, where do I put my energies, where do I put my focus, and certainly where do I put my charitable dollars. And, I've talked to a lot of smart people in recent weeks. You know, we did a series on effective giving. And, you know, one of the consensus seems to be is that you should start with what you care about. I mean, there's so many things to care about, but most of us can identify one or two causes that we feel most strongly about. And that's a great place to start. And then within that cause, to start doing some research into which charities are very effective working on that cause. And as you mentioned at the beginning of the program, Charity Navigator is one site that you can go to where a number of national charities are evaluated, and I would imagine maybe even some in there in New Hampshire. And then there's GiveWell, but they only evaluate just a handful of charities and recommend a handful at a time. So they don't tell you which charities are bad. They don't do a broad spectrum of charities, just a few, but that's a very good resource to find out, you know, what they think are the most effective charities out in the world based on very intensive research that they've done. And, you know, I think, though, there is a risk that we do feel so overwhelmed that we do nothing or that we ignore the evidence that is out there, and that might be a topic for another time, but, you know, there is a bit of evidence out there that even when we find out which charities are effective, we still tend to go with, well, my family member has this disease, and so I'm going to give to the, you know, American Cancer Society, or my son is in the Boy Scouts, and I'm going to give to them. We tend to give to causes that we are close to our hearts, even though we haven't done the research to find out if those are effective. And so a lot of smart people would say you need to do some research there and find out how effective these charities are.
Well, we'll definitely talk about effectiveness because that's kind of a buzzword among charitable circles these days. You can join us, too. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, today in the exchange, the ins and outs of charitable giving, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. What about services like Charity Navigator? That's the most famous one. There's also GiveWell. I want to talk to both of you about this a little bit more, but go ahead, Mary Ellen Jackson.
You know, there's weaknesses and strengths to all these tools. And one of the weaknesses we've read a lot about it with Charity Navigator is they originally just got swept up into overhead. So this is a huge myth in the nonprofit sector. Overhead is healthy. I want to invest in a nonprofit that understands that to deliver and have impact, it needs skilled people, it needs resources, it needs technology, it needs marketing. And over time, I think Charity Navigator, through some of the great thinkers like Dan Pallotta, turned around its viewpoint. It's not just a financial picture. I love the story of Warren Buffett, and he gave a very significant gift to a food shelter, a shelter and a food pantry in the Seattle area. And somebody said to him, so what were the outcomes? What were the measurable results, this organization? And he just looked at them and said, I walked in. I saw people being fed. So I think that a lot of this is on somewhat of a tiered basis. If you want to give local, you know, in your neighborhood, in your community, you can look around and see what's going on. It's pretty obvious whether it's a local historical society, choral group, whether it's a land trust, or whether it's a social service program. But as you go up the tiers, things do get more complex. And some donors really want to give to a deeper system change. And so I think you have to step back from just the financial picture because strong organizations are needed in this country. These problems are complex, even on the local level.
Well, and we'll definitely dig into that a little bit later, sort of the local versus national versus international, lots of questions around that. But just to focus again a little bit more on these resources that help people navigate. What do you think, Amy? Some people have said that Charity Navigator focuses too much just on the financials and how much overhead does an institution have and how much do they pay their leadership and so forth, and do they have a big marketing budget? And people look at that and go, well, I want my dollars to go straight to the person in need. But Mary Ellen's making the point that you also want a strong organization. So what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I know the question of overhead comes up a lot and is a big concern of donors, and perhaps increasingly so. And I think that a lot of smart people would say that that is not an effective way to measure a charity. And there are some, you know, you don't want an executive to be overpaid relative to the annual budget of the organization. But do you want the smartest people available to be trying to tackle some of the hardest issues in the state of New Hampshire, in the country, in the world? And these reasons, you know, these problems still exist because they are hard to solve. And because of that, we need bright people who won't go to the private sector leading these organizations. And I think that might be one of the best cases for that. You want their staff to have adequate, you know, communication tools, computers, things like that. So, you know, I would never say that overhead necessarily is a meaningful way to measure a charity, and although it should be factored into one of them, I would just say about Charity Navigator, it's really the only game in town, as far as I know, with respect to you know, broad scale charity evaluation, the numbers that they evaluate. But it is a process for them. You know, they're basically measuring the financial health of an organization and something they call accountability and transparency. But what that doesn't tell me is the impact the organization is having. And that, you know, is a question that really might be most important. Is this nonprofit affecting positive change in the community? Are their projects having long-term impact in the communities that they are, say, that they are helping? And, you know, it's hard, you know, a lot of people, and that often comes down to the individual donor. What kind of change are you expecting to see in this organization? What kind of change is important to you? And Charity Navigator isn't going to give you a lot of information, as far as I know, and maybe, Mary Ellen, you'll have a different opinion about that, but, you know, I think that's where we fall short. And I think, you know, that's part of the work that I've been trying to do as a reporter, is to follow up on some of these initiatives that sound really great on paper, that we understand are having impact. But how do we know unless we get out into the field, look at the beneficiaries in the eye, and see how these projects are impacting their lives? In some ways, that's the most important question to me about a nonprofit, is what kind of impact are they having in the lives of the people they're trying to help? And unfortunately, it's very hard to find a tool out there that will tell you that, with the exception of GiveWell. Just one other quick resource that I would point out is GuideStar, and that's guidestar.org, and that's a site that any donor can get on and look up any registered nonprofit in the United States. And what they get there is something called the IRS Form 990. That's a tax form that all registered nonprofits in the U.S. are required to file. And that can be just a really interesting little bit of piece of information, because you can see a lot of their financials there, what their top executives are getting paid, what they pay their highest paid contractors, what some of their overhead costs are, including their fundraising costs. So that's just one of the resources for people who would like to find out a little bit more about a particular organization they're considering giving to.
Well, it's so interesting to hear you say that. So, because Mary Ellen, as you know, it's a data-driven world. There's so much data out there. And yet, Amy's telling us that we really don't have a great way to measure impact.
Well, I think we're getting swept up into looking at some of the wrong data. And, you know, there's real-time impact. And then there's system change, and there's change over time. And I think the nonprofit sector is in this massive stage of transition. And we need the, you know, a very good investment would be an investment in how to get your hands around what is real time. Like I was talking with a donor recently, and he's like, I'm not sure. I'm hearing buzz that this organization isn't having any real change, and children aren't, you know, in the city of Manchester reaching third grade ready to read. And I'm like, well, let's look at what that organization does, because in real time, they're creating a safe place for that child to be after school, or they're in real time. What's happening with the family right now is really making a dent for the long term. But getting your hands around why a home visit from a mental health center provider, what's that impact? These are tough challenges, and this is where we need to invest. If you look at GuideStar, we, you know, people know that I recently transitioned out of my role, and we have a wonderful new executive director coming on board. But one of our candidates looked at GuideStar and came to all these conclusions about our financial picture because the whole story isn't there. There isn't a sense of – GuideStar won't tell you that you've just gotten a commitment of a three-year pledge from a donor. And so it's – all these pieces come into a puzzle, but one taken separately can give you sort of a off-kilter picture. And the other thing is we're continuing the conversation about small issues that have actually prevented issues in finance, issues in capacity building that have prevented progress in the sector. We've just got to change the conversation.
What do you mean by that,
Marianne? Well, instead of talking about if we want to have impact with families, with sustaining the arts, with protecting our environment, spending enormous amounts of time analyzing the salary of the executive director or the fundraising issue is a fascinating one because I'd like to see organizations put more money into their fundraising staff because that would result in more money to do good. And so we got to reframe the conversation and say we've got to get a sense of what it takes in capacity to have impact. And we're not having that conversation.
We're focused on the data that we have, even though you're saying it's not.
Well, it's
that
lopsided.
Useful.
I think I've often wanted to do a parody. Don't have thin overhead, pay your CEO as low as possible, as modest salary, try to do everything with volunteers. But on the flip side, why aren't you making more mission impact? And how come, you know, you haven't moved the dial on this issue? So the balance has to be there.
Again, our phone number for you to join us here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. We asked our listeners on Facebook, how do you decide which charities and nonprofits to give to? Here's a sampling of what they said. Jenny said, research all charities on this independent organization's website, charitynavigator.org. Erna says, Salvation Army, Southern Baptist Conference, because they get to disasters fast, feed people, and don't charge them. And Len says, I follow my passion. What do you think about that last comment, Amy, from Len? You know, in the long run, follow your passion. What do you really care about?
Yeah, I think a lot of people would say that that is a great place to start, again, because it can feel overwhelming and that, you know, there is pressure sometimes to feel like, well, oh, I should support this cause because, you know, somebody told me that, you know, I should feel badly for children overseas who are malnourished. But, you know, what I really care about is, you know, a ballet troupe in New Hampshire somewhere. You know, I think that that's, you know, some people would say that's okay, that you should, in fact, follow your passions and not what somebody tells you you should do. And, you know, I think people will generally differ on that. And just to wrap up on this idea of impact, I think one thing that people are concerned about is that this drive to measure impact may steer nonprofits away from the hardest causes. And I think that's just one other thing to think about when we demand impact from nonprofits, as we increasingly do. Well, does that incentivize nonprofits to take on easier cases so that their metrics will, you know, and their outcomes will look better? And I think that's something to really think about and ponder and to maybe consider going with some of these nonprofits who are taking on the hardest cases, who may not have the great progress to report, but still stick with it nonetheless.
So look at not only, you know, how many children are, to use Mary Ellen's example, reading at third grade level after 5 years, but also, Mary Ellen, look at, okay, what were these kids like beforehand? So I think Amy's making an interesting point. I wonder what you think.
Oh, that's, you know, and that's why it's complex, because it's hard to tell that story. And you have, you know, amazing nonprofits in New Hampshire. I mean, we talk a lot about the work family resource centers are doing, Families in Transition. And when you sit and you talk with them and you read about what they're trying to do, that's exactly what they're doing. They're looking at the set of factors, often programs that engage parenting and better parenting skills. You're going to see the results about two generations down the road.
Because
you know, in terms of, well, that's the thing. You'll see immediate real-time results that the family will be calmed and focused and stabilized. You'll see improvements soon. But in about, you know, maybe two generations, you're going to see kids going into higher ed and college, et cetera. So, you know, these problems are rooted in a variety of issues.
Well, more on charitable giving in a moment. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the ins and outs of charitable giving. In the holiday season, many Granite Staters think about donations to charities and nonprofits in New Hampshire and elsewhere that work on a wide array of causes. Deciding where to give can be tough, though, with questions about which groups use the money most effectively, how to judge their performance. That's what we're looking at today in The Exchange. We'd love to hear from you. How do you decide to give your charitable dollars? How do you judge effectiveness? How do you pick the nonprofits and the causes that mean the most to you? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Amy and Mary Ellen, let's go to the phones. And Steve's joining us from Nottingham. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm going to go in a little different direction. I'm a member of a president of a synagogue. I'm a member of the Appalachian Mountain Club. I'm part of the forum, a nonprofit newspaper. So I have, in this time of year, I'm calling a lot of people for money. When I call people, this guy gave me this incredibly great idea. He says that he gets called by many people and gets a lot of emails and letters asking for money. What he does is develops an Excel sheet. On that Excel sheet, he puts down whom he's given to, when, and how much. Now, because, for example, my college Tufts keeps on sending me stuff, give, and I finally realize I've already given to them. So this simple tool, you can at least figure out what you're doing and how you've done it, so you can prioritize what you're doing on a personal level. And this is on your own computer, an Excel sheet.
That's my idea. Keep track, at least, of what you're doing. And there certainly are a lot of appeals this time of year. I'm interested, Mary Ellen, you first. He said that he's a member of a synagogue. New Hampshire is a remarkably unreligious state compared to other states. I think us in Vermont, sort of bounce along the bottom in terms of attendance at houses of worship, be they synagogues or churches or whatever. How does that play into charitable giving here in the Granite State?
Well, it sort of skews our data. So there again is another data thing. New Hampshire will come out on the bottom of the barrel for giving, but it's really not true. New Hampshire is actually in the top quadrant of giving. It's just that we are very independent Yankee thinkers, and down in the South, so much of work is done by religious-based nonprofits. So there's a heavy culture in the South of not only is the church providing or the synagogue providing spiritual education and comfort and support, but the churches are involved in child care centers and food pantries and learning. I've gone down to Louisville and seen a church that was doing all the social services. So we are not known for giving religiously. To the depth, we're a small state. And when you see a state like Tennessee and Alabama, the flip side of the coin is they're really suffering from more intensive mental health services, et cetera.
A lot more poverty there than
New Hampshire,
here.
Yeah, New Hampshire really gives strong. It's just that we don't give as strong to religion, and that skews the data. So it makes us look like we're at the bottom of the giving pyramid. We were actually the worst state for a while. But when you take the religious giving out, we bounce right back up to the top.
Although if the religious institutions in other states are doing all these good works, then that's still helping. So,
oh, yeah. It's just categories. I mean, they're just categorizing. This is just a way of putting out the data. Their giving comes out to the public under the religious category. If they also were evaluated under the simply nonprofit charitable status, it would be equalized.
Amy, have you written or looked at this issue of, religiosity and how that plays into charitable giving?
I must admit I haven't, although I know that a large amount of our charitable giving nationally does go to religious institutions and organizations that are doing work on their behalf. But I can comment on one other thing that the caller talked about, which is getting solicited multiple times throughout the year from an organization. And I did interview Stacey Palmer. She's the editor of the Chronicle Philanthropy. And what she said some nonprofits and smart nonprofits are doing these days is asking donors how frequently they want to be solicited each year. And maybe it's only once or maybe it's twice. And so, you know, but one thing you can do is proactively just simply call the nonprofit or write to them or email them after you've made your charitable donation and say, I hope to not hear from you for another year, or I hope to hear from you again in 2 months. And I think that's a reasonable request to make. And it helps, you know, the donor still feel good about the nonprofit, because I think maybe sometimes when you feel that you're being over-solicited by a nonprofit, that can cause some you know, harsh feelings. Although, you know, fundraising is absolutely essential, and we understand why nonprofits have to do it. Some communication can go on about how often you would like to be solicited by that nonprofit.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that, Amy, because an email just came in from Nan in Stratum, who says, related to what you were saying, I get frustrated receiving continuous mail solicitations after making a one-time donation in memory of or honor of someone who has passed away. Nan says, it makes me feel like my donation simply ended up covering the mailings to myself and nothing more. She says, I've ended up spending time repeatedly contacting these charities to stop the mailings. Because of this, there are organizations to whom I will no longer donate. Nan, thank you for the email. And so, Amy, that's what you're talking about. People start to feel hounded sometimes.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate, isn't it? And I think, you know, just like a friend who doesn't listen to us, you know, we want to think that a nonprofit that we're supporting listens to us. And so I think to feel not heard, you know, as Nan is feeling, would be understandably kind of an alienating experience and a frustrating one. And just one other thing about solicitations that come over the phone, also talking to Stacey Palmer at the Chronicle Philanthropy about this. She says it's really important if you get solicited by phone to ask quite a few questions up front about who this nonprofit is that is asking for your money and to find out if they are a professional fundraiser. And Mary Ellen, you may be able to speak to this as well, but it's been well documented that professional fundraising firms who call your home on the behalf of a nonprofit will often take a considerable chunk of your donation and keep it for themselves for the private firm, and then another portion goes to the nonprofit. And sometimes organizations can call your home masquerading as a well-known organization with just a slight change of name and actually be an entirely different nonprofit altogether. And there are some scams that go on this way. And Stacey Palmer says that they often, or, you know, frequently will target older folks. And so, again, something to be mindful of. Now, not to say that every solicitation that comes by phone or mail isn't valid. They, you know, many of them absolutely are. But it is important to ask a few questions. How much of my dollar will go to the nonprofit if I give to you over the phone? And an easy way around that to avoid any of those pitfalls is to simply not give by phone, but get online and go to the charity's website and give directly there so you know where your dollars are going.
Mary Ellen, go ahead.
Well, Amy, you raised wonderful points, and here's the irony of the whole thing. It's I totally agree. I hate to be asked over the phone, and once I give, I may not want to give again, or I may. You know, sometimes it works in the reverse, that I'm really glad I got the newsletter to tell me what I could do next. But both of your points do raise the entire issue of capacity. It would be terrific to turn to a nonprofit that you believed in and you really wanted to see their work continue and say, what do you need in the form of technology? It's always going to be about relationships. I just did a program up in Keene. I met 18 young people from a company up in Keene. They all want to give. They all want to be involved. And yet they do want the emails. They want it easy as pie to be able to give. And so it's a complex issue, but it again talks to how important it is to have the infrastructure that you can, you know, pull away a bit from the phone calls and the emails and go into relationship building, because that is always where the most fruitful fundraising happens and the most meaningful giving. So again, you underscore the whole point of turning to a nonprofit and saying, I'd like to invest in your ability to fundraise with a lot more care and a lot more attention to stewarding donors. And I have to say, this is the perfect role for board members.
Well, this is easier to do when you give locally. If you want to help solve malaria in Africa, it's a little bit trickier to have that, you know, direct contact. And I definitely want to talk to both of you about that local, national, global in a moment. But let's go back to our listeners. And Adam is in Nashua. Hi, Adam. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
So I called in because I help run a nonprofit makerspace in Nashua. We're the first one in the state, and we've currently had an opportunity to move to a new building. And we're involved with a project from the CDFA, which is the Community Development Finance Authority. And it's a unique organization in Nashua because it basically allows nonprofits to apply for tax credits to help fund specific projects. And then it does the vetting of the nonprofits and the projects and picks from all those that apply for the ones that actually get awarded. And then how this helps us is that businesses that then pledge to whatever project is selected will receive 75% of their donation back as New Hampshire tax credits that can be carried forward for up to 5 years. So it allows them to make much bigger donations into vested projects than they normally could just as a charitable donation.
Wow, Adam, thank you for calling. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Mary Ellen?
Sure. You know, Adam brings up another good point. You can look at a nonprofit and see where the other sources of funding are coming from. It could be in their annual report. It could be on their website. Some of these sources of funding, to be honest with you, the CDFA puts you to a tough test. When you get funding from them, they're scrutinizing your financials. They're coming to see if you have the bandwidth to carry the project on. The New Hampshire Center got a CDFA approval, and it was really intense. So when you see that an organization's been through the CDFA process or the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation's grant-making process or the Endowment for Health or another funder, that's another good litmus test that if they've met their criteria and received a grant. And the other thing is you can look at who's donating. So there's a lot of ways to be reassured that the work is getting done.
So that's a local check on charitable effectiveness.
Yeah, and I think CDFA, there's a community development fund. I think they're located in other states. But in every state, there are funding mechanisms. There's funders that at one point in time, the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits got a grant from Fidelity, and the scrutiny was intense.
Our phone number again for you to join us like Adam did, and Adam, thank you for that one, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, the ins and outs of charitable giving. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us with your questions, comments, thoughts on this idea of giving effectively, how to decide this time of year when there are so many appeals for donations. Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email from Gary in Sugar Hill who says, great program. Outcomes and impact for large charities are too big to measure unless you're giving millions, but local giving feels like it has an impact, i.e. food pantry, fuel assistance, clothing thrift stores, etc., never have enough to work with. Here's another email from Christine, who says, I live in the North Country where the economy is still quite horrible. I get frustrated hearing donors and foundations talking about sustainability and outcomes, wanting to hear, quote, compelling stories that do nothing but help donors feel good about themselves. Christine says, up here, right now, the outcomes are that hungry people get fed, cold people stay warm, and communities have places to gather and to feel a part of life. Christine says, sustainability, outcomes measurements, to me, these are wonderful annual report terms and impressive topics for cocktail parties, but needy people are needy people. This is a big question that I want to ask both of you, and thank you to Gary and Christine. Amy, here's the question that a lot of people have this time of year. Local, national, international, we hear about, you know, AIDS and malaria in Africa, but we also hear about, you know, food pantries like Gary mentions. What do you think?
Yeah. Again, you know, there's no right answer for this, of course, and thoughtful people will disagree about the importance of giving locally versus globally. I did talk to a guy named Charlie Bressler. He runs an organization called The Life You Can Save, and people looking for effective charities that do good work with the neediest people living in developing nations can go to that website and find a list of vetted organizations that purport to do a lot with your small donations, you know, organizations that are providing bed nets to prevent malaria, organizations that for $50 to $75 you can remove cataracts from someone who would otherwise be blind or go blind. And, you know, there's an interesting kind of movement underway called effective altruism. And the life you can save is part of that movement. And the idea behind that is that donors should put their money to where their dollars can be stretched the farthest. And effective altruists will say that happens in developing nations with highly effective charities, that your $25, your $50, your $500 can go much farther there and help those who need help the most. So do you give to the, you know, shelter in Nashua, or do you give to a child who is malnourished or possibly dying in Malawi? And Charlie Bressler in The Life You Can Save, an effective altruist, would say, if all lives are equal, if we agree that every life has equal value, then it is incumbent upon us as donors to give to those whose lives are most at risk first. Again, not everyone agrees with this. Effective altruists also like to see people saving more of their disposable income each year so that they have more to give at the end of the year. So rather than spending money on luxury items that we don't need, effective altruists would like to see more of us saving our money so that we can give to both local and international causes.
So, Amy, here's the question that I often get, and that, you know, I sometimes myself ask when I get these appeals from, you know, cataracts in Malawi, for example. Yeah. There's a skepticism in America that that $50 is really going to go toward that one person and give them their cataract surgery.
Well, you know, like I said, like The Life You Can Save has investigated a few of these nonprofits that are doing the cataract surgery removal. And, you know, as far as they tell us through the research that they've done, these are highly effective charities. And, you know, I don't know if it's important to you if you're saying, well, it's important that I know I'm going to get cataract surgery to Joe Smith in Malawi, or is it just important to you that somebody in Malawi gets cataract surgery?
A person, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, is that more about us as a donor or more about wanting to help the cause? So, there's another whole conversation to be had about how our own motives are tied up in philanthropy and how, you know, we want to feel good. And that's okay, and that's important. But if we really want to help people who need cataract surgery in sub-Saharan Africa, I wouldn't be too concerned that it's Joe Smith I know is getting the surgery. I just want to know this is a highly effective organization giving life-transforming surgery to people who need it. That's really the end goal, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think this the problem that some people in this country have is that sounds great, but they're not really sure that that's going to happen. So you're saying this particular organization that you're mentioning, Effective Altruism, they're kind of checking it out for us, making sure that that really does happen on the ground?
Yeah, just like, you know, the GiveWell does, who we talked about earlier. They, too, have vetted a lot of organizations doing a lot of work in developing nations, largely along the lines of public health initiatives, transformative work that, you know, deworming organizations who, you know, do that kind of work for school children who would otherwise be out of school. So, yeah, I mean, there's absolutely some resources out there. The Life You Can Save is one of them that has vetted some of these organizations working in developing nations, doing highly effective work where your small donation has large impact in the lives of others.
And Mary Ellen, I want you to tackle this as well. We might not be able to finish it before the break, but go ahead. Local,
okay.
National, international.
You know, I get concerned, too, with, everyone has their bias. There's what you should be doing and which cause is better. It's a conversation that I sort of steer away from. I think that a person in need is a person in need, and you should do what you feel is right and then look around and give. And when we get back, I hope we can talk a little bit more about the sustainability, because
okay,
we're learning a lot about that.
All right. More on effective giving in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, deciding where to donate, given all the appeals from charitable organizations and nonprofits this time of year. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests are Amy Costello, host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates philanthropy and nonprofits. You can find Amy at tinyspark.org. Amy's also a former Africa correspondent for the public radio program the world. Mary Ellen Jackson is with us, consultant and special projects contractor for the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits. And Mary Ellen, just before the break, you were saying you want to talk about, there's another sort of word floating around today in the world of charitable giving, sustainability. Go ahead.
Absolutely. And my heart goes out to the caller from up north, and I see this all over the state. We're on a journey. The donor community, the philanthropic community, the foundation community, and nonprofits, we grabbed hold of this word that we want to see sustainability. We want to see that whatever we give to you, you'll figure out how to sustain that and keep going, even when the gift is gone, when the grant is gone. And there's some new, and like I said, we're on this journey together. We're learning what that means. And there's a terrific gentleman and woman out in the West Coast from Compass Point that wrote a book called The Sustainability Mindset. And the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits brought Steve Zimmerman here for our summit, and I know they're going to continue to bring him here. But in a nutshell, sustainability is not a destination. It's a set of behaviors. And so when we look at the nonprofits up north, we got to commend them for their adaptability, for their ability to shift, for their ability to engage volunteers. And this is happening all over the state. So when we look for sustainability, has that nonprofit been able to adapt to the times? Has it used volunteers creatively? Has it figured out, despite all odds, that it has gotten resources to the people in need? So sustainability is more than just, did you figure out a way to cover that money that we gave you last year, this year on your own?
It's tricky, though. Things are always tight.
And it's not easy.
All right, let's take another call. This is Tom in Danbury. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. We did an experiment last year. We, along about December, we started making donations. We made donations to maybe about 15 or so charities. They weren't huge. They were $25 to $100 each. And then in January, we discovered that we were getting a lot more letters. And so along about June, we decided that we would collect the letters for the rest of the year, which we did, and the experiment is now coming to a close. The grand total is about 1.25 cubic feet of letters, and it weighs 27 pounds.
Wow, Tom.
And this occurs to us that there's a number of charities that have spent all the money that we gave them sending letters to us. And what we're now going to do is go through them and find out who the big offenders are, and they will be off our list.
Wow. Yeah, because you just get frustrated with all the mail and worried about the cost. Tom, if I could push at you a little bit, since this is something you clearly care about, what if one of the biggest offenders, to use your words, is a group that's really doing something really important?
Well, I don't know what to do about it. I'll probably send them a letter.
Yeah.
There are a couple that I know that have given us far much more mail than we could possibly respond to. And I just know that from watching the stuff coming in.
Well, Tom, thank you. And I love hearing about his experiment. And this gets back to what we talked about before, Amy and Mary Ellen. People are frustrated by the just seeming unending appeals. And Tom actually weighed it and measured it. Mary Ellen, what do you think? But I want to hear from you too, Amy. Go ahead.
You know, that's not good. And I've had many people say to me, we need to invest in the fundraising education for nonprofits, because what I think is happening is I don't have a fundraising staff. I got this donation, and somebody told me that if I wrote a letter 3 months later, I'd get another one and another one and another one. When these organizations don't have talented development staff guiding them and saying no, when somebody gives you a donation, your next step isn't to ask for more. Your next step is to thank them several times, ask them if they would like to visit the center, ask them if they would like more information. But because resources are slim and somebody has said to them, just keep pumping out letters. And so, again, I think that it would be great to craft a synopsis of what you did and then think about, could we invest in education on really appropriate fundraising that is much more personal and not, you know, using money to just pump out a next letter?
What do you think about this comment, Amy? And Tom, again, thank you for calling.
Yeah, a really fascinating and kind of sad experiment. One that speaks volumes, literally and figuratively. I mean, I think it might be worth calling some of those organizations and expressing your dismay about the level of solicitation you received since giving to that organization. It's good for them to get feedback. That can be healthy and helpful for them. But it would be a shame, as Mary Ellen pointed out, if this organization that has sent you too many letters is in fact doing great work. And so maybe that's a conversation worth having. And just one other thing I want to pick up on, the listener who wrote about working up in the North Country, feeding people, clothing them, giving them their immediate needs. And I think that that is so important, obviously, when people are hungry to feed them and when people need clothes to give them clothes, especially in this cold weather. However, at the same time, I think it's also important that we look to organizations, to support organizations who are helping to make those situations not be so prevalent, to work with organizations who are helping people no longer be homeless, no longer be hungry, no longer be unemployed. Because while those services, those direct services, are vitally important, I think we also need to simultaneously keep our eyes on where we're going with this and trying to mitigate those problems so that those needs are lessened, so that we can actually get people on the road to self-sufficiency, onto road to employment. And so I think, you know, those direct service organizations are doing really important work, but we also need to try to ideally put them out of business, right? So that's just one other reflection I have on that caller.
No, that's a tough one, and I'm glad you raised it. I know there's some conversations, Mary Ellen, going on right here in New Hampshire.
Absolutely.
About, you know, especially with the winter coming, do we shelter homeless people so they don't freeze, or do we, you know, work longer term to create some kind of new housing model so people aren't homeless in the first place? So I appreciate what you're saying there, Amy. I don't know if you want to comment, Mary Ellen.
I think we do both, and I think that's where you have this tiered approach and you understand what's going on. You know, we have this heroin epidemic. We have research that needs to be done. We have experimentation for solutions to be done. And so I think on different levels, different people will want to give to direct services. Other people will want to give to new systems that can make a difference. Other people want to give to housing. So it's your choice where you want to attack the problem.
Well, here's an email from Margie in Barnstead that asks a question that I had myself. So thank you, Margie, for asking it. She says, how do charities get the most bang out of my buck by my giving more to a few or less to many? Now, this is a great question, Margie. Thank you. Amy, if I have $100, is it better for me to give $10 to 10 organizations or $100 to one organization? Margie, thanks again for the email.
Yeah, again, and I simply report on the sector. I'm not from it, and so there's probably a lot more smarter people who could answer this in a more meaningful way. But what I can tell you is that, again, if we go to the effective altruist idea, that idea would be if you have $100, it should be spent in a developing nation with a highly effective organization, and $100 can do a lot of good there. However, I think everyone agrees that we should, you know, when we see these big gifts being given by Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook and millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars being given by big donors, sometimes that can make us ordinary donors feel like, well, yeah, my $25 doesn't really make a difference, but in fact it does. And there's many organizations right there in New Hampshire, in this country, who can really use your $25, your $100 donation. And one final thought I'll say on this that I, Stacey Palmer of the Chronicle Philanthropy told me, is that what you should think about is not just giving $100 right now, but to give a sustaining gift every month to a charity that you support. That's a much healthier way for an organization to receive your money, is small donations over the course of an entire year, a direct debit from your card. Can be very helpful because, you know, for all the focus to be on this one time of year, Giving Tuesday, holiday giving, is not as effective as giving all the way throughout the year in a small sum that you can afford. And Stacey said this is very popular in other countries, especially in Europe, and is gaining traction here.
Let's take another call. This is Karen calling in from Bow. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
I want to follow on from the question with the gentleman who had these 27 pounds of literature. I asked the question. We get lots of phone calls and charities, and I asked the question, what percentage goes to administration and what goes directly to the charity? Now, I'm somewhere that, and in fact, they always do know the number, or they'll get somebody on the line that knows that number. And I'm sorry to say that in some cases, it's as little as 7%.
That goes to the actual cause, Karen?
To the actual cause. And so we have a little litmus test that we do. You know, we don't do anything at 60% or above.
Okay.
We prefer 8%, but that's a question everybody can ask if they get a phone call, is what percentage does go to the charity, and it's quite shocking.
Well, Karen, thank you for calling. And Mary Ellen, you talked about this earlier, but let's tackle it again. You said, you know, don't only look at how much goes to overhead, administration, salaries, marketing, because you want an effective organization solving some of the toughest problems out there. On the other hand, is there a point at which it does get to be concerning, as our caller Karen says? And Karen, thank you again for calling in.
excuse me. Oh, sure. I mean, there is a point at which your eyebrows have to go up if the organization seems to be focused on paying its staff and then a small, tiny portion goes out to the mission. But I think we have to weigh in that a lot of organizations, their overhead is their mission delivery. They're paying their staff to deliver services that may be therapeutic, that may be a service that the person is the service. So that's one thing to think about. You know, there's ratios of 20. It used to be people would think, oh, if your overhead is more than 15%, you're not a good charity. Well, that's very arbitrary. It's just, what does that mean? And what are you categorizing? If I'm an employee of a mental health center and I go out and I provide a mental health appointment, am I overhead? Am I administration? What am I? So part of it is that we're learning how to categorize and fill out appropriate financials that describe what is direct service. So, you know, like any good business, there's a balance, and I think people tend to now think, you know, 25% to overhead is acceptable, if not required.
Okay, Karen, thank you for the call. And, you know, Amy, here's another question that I had. We've talked a lot this hour about people have called and said they feel overwhelmed by the mail, and other people have called and said they don't like the phone solicitations, and absolutely understood. How do you see charities these days, Amy, navigating contacting people? People don't want piles of snail mail. I love Tom's call, who had, you know, who knows how many pounds of snail mail, the phone solicitations and so forth. Email these days sometimes gets lost in the sauce. We get so many emails. Some organizations are using texting successfully. I just wonder what you see out there, Amy, in terms of organizations using new tools to reach people, given how people feel, well, some distaste for the old tools.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's all kinds of innovative ways that many organizations, nonprofits and for-profits alike, are communicating with their supporters, you know, much of that increasingly going toward social media, Twitter, Facebook, and things like that. But, you know, I think what strikes me above all with these kinds of conversations is that we can turn it off in a way. You know, I mean, you know, you can just throw the mail solicitation into the recycling bin. You cannot engage with the phone solicitors. You know, if that's what gives you peace of mind and enables you to stay engaged in the space, because when I hear these kinds of conversations, I also begin to get concerned that we focus on feeling over-solicited, and so then I don't really necessarily want to do anything, or I don't want to support these charities anymore. And that's like the most unfortunate outcome we could talk about, right? And so, you know, I would kind of put it back to the listeners and the donors to say, well, how can you kind of turn it off? You know, nobody's forcing you to give to any of these organizations. And maybe, and again, when it's not such a busy time of year, which this time of year inevitably is for all of us, you know, in May or June or when you're on the beach in August, why not kind of give some thought to the organizations that you want to support and support those and throw everything else into the recycling bin?
Let's take one more call. This is Mike in Nashua. Hi, Mike. You're in the Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Fine.
So I wanted to comment on the discussion that was about a couple of minutes ago about, you know, what do I do with my $100? And then the comment was made also as far as giving across the year.
Sure. Go ahead, Mike.
So I am actually president of United Way down here in Nashua.
Okay, and, great.
And this is such an interesting question, and I'm not answering it. Well, I am answering it a little bit self-serving, but not entirely. I would suggest that the person who's looking to take a smaller contribution and that they should look at a place where they can pool that with any number of other contributions that benefit the entire community rather than a very specific contribution that might be immediately sucked up and go away.
That's how the United Way works, right, Mike? People pool, that they give to the United Way, and then you guys parcel it out. Is that correct?
That is exactly how United Way works. So,
what are you seeing, Mike, in terms of the level of donations this year? I've heard that they're up, but not so sure. What do you think?
Well, level of donations is going to—I mean, that depends on how you look at level of donations. Our donors are primarily smaller dollar donors, like the person who called in and asked about the $100.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing neither really a decline or an increase. That's a relatively flat number for us currently at this year. That's entirely different than the answer one would give regarding, the Mark Zuckerberg type dollars.
Right.
That's just not our population.
Well, Mike, I'm glad you called. I got to cut you off there because we're ending the hour. But thank you very much for calling in, especially since, again, this is right where you're working right now with the United Way. And Amy Costello, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Amy Costello, host of Tiny Spark, a podcast that investigates philanthropy and nonprofits. You can find Amy at tinyspark.org. Mary Ellen Jackson, always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure, too, Laura.
Mary Ellen Jackson, consultant and special projects contractor for the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, which provides programs and resources to support nonprofit organizations in the state. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Dana Rosinski-Larson. Our intern is Hallie Loft. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, a checkup on the Affordable Care Act. As another health insurance enrollment period comes to an end, the conversation continues about whether or not the Affordable Care Act is working for individuals and employers in the state. We take stock of who's getting insured, what's on the horizon for Medicaid expansion, and whether the economics of the law are bringing down costs as intended. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.